From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. President Obama hosted a three-day conference in Washington on, quote, countering violent extremism, unquote, that stressed, among other things, responding effectively to the sophisticated appeals to young people by terrorist groups. In Ukraine, the ceasefire collapsed quickly as Russian-backed forces captured a key railroad town. Meanwhile, Egypt bombed ISIS forces in Libya after ISIS executed 21 Egyptian Christians. And Jeb Bush, the son and brother of presidents, said he would, quote, be my own man, unquote, if elected president in 2016. Well, we'll start with President Obama, Stephen, and I'll start with you. This conference for 3 days, I don't think there were any other heads of state there, and the conference didn't focus, as it might have, on really fighting against terrorist groups, and I'm not sure what it achieved, but all the focus was on President Obama and what he said, and he talked about other things than the use of the military against terrorists.
Right. You know, I kind of find it interesting that we're, what, 14 years since the September 11th attacks, and we're still having a debate about what causes terrorism, what makes young people radicalized, why these sort of extremist groups are so attractive. It just seems, to me, a little bit, it's an interesting subject, but I'm not really sure that it really gets to the heart of the problem we're facing against ISIS, which is spreading like wildfire through the Middle East. You have sort of affiliated terrorist groups, as you were saying, in places like Libya, who are now sort of joined the ISIS banner because it's seen as a successful group that people want to be linked with. You know, we've had this debate over the last week about, first of all, the president not wanting to sort of use the word Islamic extremism or radicalism and say we're fighting a war against it. He's been hammered by conservatives over that. And, you know, I just think this is kind of an irrelevant debate. Who cares what it's called, in a way, you know? The White House is at fault for being sort of getting lost in semantics and political correctness about, you know, what these groups are. And I think conservatives are also at fault for making that the main issue. I mean, the main issue, as far as I'm concerned, is that ISIS is gathering strength, it's gathering territory, it's gathering adherents, and nobody seems to have a workable strategy to stop it.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the issues with a conference like this is extremism is not generic. There are all types of extremism all around the world, and there's no one-size-fits-all solution to it. The things that motivate young terrorists that join FARC, for example, are not the same things that motivate terrorists who join the so-called Islamic State. So that's one of the major issues, is that the conference that was convened was too broad, 60 or so countries, plus local law enforcement all across the United States. What is the problem, really, that the White House is trying to address? It's not quite clear, because extremism isn't all the same all around the world, and it's not the same for local officials as it is in Russia or in Iraq and Syria. It's just very different. So that's one of the problems. But one thing, perhaps, that might be a unifying thread throughout it is that a lot of people, motivated perhaps less by socioeconomic circumstances than by the desire to influence events in their region, to be a part of history, to be part of some broader struggle, whether that's in Colombia or in Iraq and Syria. It's for the chance to make a difference for young people who are trying to find something to do. The United States isn't presenting a struggle for young American Muslims to say to them, hey, there is right now an epic struggle within your religion. If you value an open society, we need you to spend the rest of your life working to destroy the Islamic State and everything it represents. That kind of struggle hasn't been set up, and the White House isn't interested in creating that kind of struggle, even though I think that's probably one of the defining underlying factors of extremism.
What do you make of this debate that Stephen talked about Obama's language and not using, at least in relation to terrorism or extremism or something, the word Islamic, even though in the case of ISIS, they proclaim they're doing this out of their religious beliefs. That's why they're killing people.
For me, it's hard to fight something if you can't agree on exactly what to call it. I do think that the terminology matters here. But at the end of the day, I think that the best way to go about this really is to attack the problem head on and give young people, whether they're American, European, whatever, the chance to define a struggle between an open society and Western values and the fascism that, that we're seeing in the so-called Islamic State.
Stephen, what is the appeal of ISIS? I mean, if you're a young Muslim and you're looking at websites that terrorist groups might have, and you know, they're not urging you to come to you know, the south of France and be on the beach and so on. They're calling you to come to some pretty grim, unsafe areas of the world. And religion, in many cases, has to be a big factor.
I think religion is a big factor, but I think there's also this sense of a wider community of belonging. In many of these cities in Western Europe, Muslim communities feel themselves marginalized, perhaps. It's often the second generation of families that get sort of enticed by extremism, perhaps are growing up halfway between a Western society and an Islamic society in the middle of a city where perhaps they don't feel valued and they feel discriminated against. So I think there's definitely a sense of belonging to something wider than oneself. I think ISIS are very sophisticated in their social media strategies, their public relations strategies. So I think there's that aspect to it. Another problem, I think, though, with the president's conference is whenever you hear the words, the international community must do something, you know nothing's actually going to happen because, you know, that kind of vaunted sort of cloudy concept of the international community, it always comes up with absolutely no action. It's too nebulous. And, you know, the president's got some good points. Poverty is an issue. The lack of political freedom is an issue. But all these things are things that are going to take at least a generation to fix. They're not going to sort of influence the situation as it is right now. So, yes, it's great to have a long-term plan to address this. But in terms of the struggle against ISIS, I think it's, you know, a bit of a sideshow. One interesting fact about this conference was that the head of the FBI, James Comey, wasn't invited by the White House for some strange reason. But the head of the Russian security service, the FSB, the successor to the KGB, was there. It kind of beggars belief a little bit.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to another struggle in Ukraine. I haven't looked at the earlier ceasefires to see whether this one lasted the least amount of time. I mean, this one was agreed to by France, Germany, the United States, and Russia. And yet we're fighting again, and the Russian-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine are doing very, very well.
Right. The interesting thing will be to see whether after the fall of this city, Debeltsev, in which a great
I was avoiding
of
mentioning. I call it a railroad town.
I don't know if I got it right, but it was close enough. But,
good enough for me.
This city fell. You know, it was a strange kind of circumstance in that the ceasefire took place while a large number of Ukrainian troops were besieged inside the town, so they didn't want to give up this territory, and the rebels were obviously fighting to capture this strategic town. So the interesting thing
I think President Putin of Russia said this town was exempt from
the
ceasefire.
He sort of declared it exempt. The question now will be whether, having solidified that territory, the rebels will continue to fight. I think it's quite interesting, in the last few weeks, it seems to have started to dawn on leaders in Europe that they've got a problem with Vladimir Putin. You would have thought that they would have discover this about a year ago, but they've basically started to make public statements. The British Defense Minister was talking about this the other day, that, you know, this is a wider problem than just Ukraine, and they're, you know, increasingly fearful that Russia makes some kind of covert move on the Baltic states. You're seeing more and more patrols down the English Channel by Russian planes just kind of prodding the Western defenses. So I think the difference between this ceasefire and other ones is that now the West is thinking, wait a second, we've got a problem. We've got to actually do something about this. And that's maybe the interesting development so far and this particular sort of episode of the crisis.
And it'll be a little tougher, Tim, if Russia tries to make a move of some type on the Baltic states. They are members of NATO, but they do have minority Russian communities there. In some cases, they were colonized by Stalin back when Russia captured the Baltic states in, 1940 or something like that. But anyway, we've seen this. How many times now have we seen we have these ceasefires, and then they don't last long, and the Russian-backed forces take some land, and then we have another ceasefire, but they keep the land they took the last time. Eventually, they're going to have a big chunk of the Ukraine if this goes on.
Well, yeah, and the question is whether there's a strategic desire on behalf of Russia and the Russian-backed separatist groups to take any more land. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's one more outpost, one more town that has a majority of Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine that they haven't quite gotten yet. But right now they have the strategic victory of creating a land bridge to Crimea. Previously they couldn't get there by land. Mm-hmm. Now they can. I mean, so from a strategic standpoint, Putin has been able to achieve what his larger aims are, which is to weaken Ukraine and to prevent them from being such a large player as they shifted towards the West. Mm-hmm. And he can now look elsewhere. He can step back and look elsewhere. And that means threatening NATO countries. That means putting other people at risk. You know, it's doubtful that he'll make any such audacious move against a NATO country. But remember, Ukraine has always had the implicit and explicit backing of the United States and a lot of NATO countries. They denuclearized on the promise that the United States would be there when it mattered, and it turns out the United States wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Crimea is, I remember when the Russians annexed it, it was thought, I think the conventional wisdom was, correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, but conventional wisdom was that, well, this is all Putin wants.
Right.
And it turned out he wanted more.
Right. And I think what you could see is covert action by Putin. He doesn't need to invade any of the Baltic states. All he has to do is make life unpleasant there. He can disrupt the economy. He can sort of hit the confidence of these states and preoccupy the West. So I think that's definitely a possibility. And, you know, there was this perception in the West all along that, well, going after Crimea is not in Putin's interest and it's going to harm his economy. And what has been proven clearly is that Putin's calculation of his own interest is completely different than that of the West. So from our logical position, it may seem like he's doing foolish things, but I think it's been a failing, especially of this administration, that they tend to look at things in a logical, common sense fashion and believe eventually everyone will come around to their way of thinking. And, you know, Putin's making strategic and political calculations that are completely sort of unique to his own perception of things. And he just doesn't act logically and rationally in a way. But if you go into his own mindset, from his point of view, he's acting completely rationally. Sure. So, you know, it's very difficult to deter someone like that.
It is. I remember when one of his first incursions, Tim, the response of John Kerry, the American Secretary of State, was, oh, he's made a terrible error. We need to get an exit ramp so he can stop doing what he's doing. Well, he wanted to do what he was doing. I'm talking about Putin, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And it does seem like the United States has underestimated the degree to which Putin is willing to put his country's strategic resources online in order to, you know, invade another country or challenge the West.
Yeah, I've certainly underestimated him, and I think everybody else has in the U.S. media, among other things, in Europe, too. Anyway, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington, in frigid Washington, where there's a cold spell. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Stephen Collinson of CNN Politics and Tim Mack of the Daily Beast. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. This program is also available for a free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issuesinthenews. Well, let's turn to Egypt. And 21 Christians from Egypt were executed by ISIS rather dramatically and visibly, because they seem to like to spread these videos around of their executions. This happened in Libya. And the president of Egypt, formerly a general, Sisi, sent bombers over Libya to attempt to punish ISIS by bombing their supposed camps. These things are very difficult to do from the air. The U.S. did not back this attack. Stephen, why not?
It's kind of a reflection of the tension there still is between the Washington and Egypt following the coup masterminded by Sisi and the sort of rigged election that took place last year. The Pentagon wasn't told in advance that this was going to take place by the Egyptians, even though, you know, both countries are ostensibly fighting the same enemy, ISIS. It's interesting that, you know, the White House believes that Sisi is taking Egypt on a path that in the long term is counterproductive. He's locked up thousands of Muslim Brotherhood supporters after sort of ousting the first democratically elected leader of Egypt, Morsi, in 2013. He's cracked down on political freedoms. There's a lot of still religious repression against Christians and Jews in Egypt. So the White House believes that Sisi is not leading Egypt on a path that ultimately is going to be sustainable in the fight against Islamic fundamentalism, What's actually very interesting is that a bunch of Republican presidential candidates have repeatedly praised Sisi because he gave a speech at the turn of the year in which he basically said that, you know, Islam is in danger of being destroyed by fundamentalism and extremism, and the rest of the world is not going to stand for this. A lot of candidates, including Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush talked about it this week, Mike Huckabee have sort of held this up as the kind of rhetoric the President of the United States should be adopting, you know, kind of turning a blind eye to the repressive nature of some of Sisi's actions. I think what we're seeing is, again, this long-term tension in U.S.-Egypt relations between the desire to push for democracy and more political freedoms and the desire to have a stable pro-U.S. ally, you know, the most powerful, symbolically important Arab state. So I think if one of these Republicans becomes the president, we might see the sort of pendulum swing a little bit back towards the sort of more pragmatic view of Egypt that has historically, until the Arab Spring, been the one that's prevailed in Washington.
You know, I take what Stephen has said, and I don't necessarily disagree with it, Tim, but isn't President Obama in a really a huge struggle in the Middle East, being a little picky about who his allies are?
Well, I, you know,
in the
case
of Egypt.
Well, the thing about Egypt is, let's just say, you know, a military dictatorship in theory should be quite good for American-Egyptian relations because, like, the vast majority of military leaders in Egypt have trained at American military academies.
Indeed.
They have deep, deep ties. And so the fact that these two ostensible allies are not able to see eye to eye on a common goal, which they already agree on, is really telling about the state of relations in the region. I mean, the United States, you know, the White House last week put forward a war authorization bill with no geographical limits. That is, that they should be able to target and strike at ISIS anywhere they wanted in the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, apparently there is no theoretical objection to hitting ISIS camps in Libya. The real problem here is diplomatic and personal even.
Mm-hmm. What about the broader question? I'm going to turn to Jeb Bush in a minute, but I want to ask about this because I was struck by somebody reporting that the U.S. has really pulled out of four countries in the Middle East extended. One of them is Libya, which is actually in northern Africa, but the other three are Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. Embassies have been closed in a couple of them, and when you do that, you're certainly not having a show of strength.
Well, that's correct. And as the U.S. has pulled out, guess who's gone into those countries? It's Iran, spreading its influence throughout the Middle East. Iran was, you know, back the Houthi rebels that took over the U.S.-backed government in Yemen. Mm-hmm. You know, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard seems to spend his time shuttling between Damascus and Baghdad and Tehran, sort of masterminding pro-Shiite governments in Iran. One of the reasons why the spread of ISIS has been checked in Iraq is not because the Iraqi armed forces have been doing this. It's Shiite militias that have been stood up by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards that have sort of made sort of advances on the ground at the same time as the U.S. air campaign has sort of pegged back ISIS from the air. So, you know, there is this battle going on in the Middle East between Shiite states led by Iran and Sunni-backed groups led by Saudi Arabia, almost a Cold War, if you like, at the same time as the region is being ripped to pieces by sectarian and, you know, violence. So you can make a very good argument that countries like Egypt are looking at the U.S., not seeing a partner, and inviting people like Vladimir Putin to come in and, you know, back into the Middle East. Putin was greeted as a hero last week when he went on a visit to Cairo. You know, this idea that the administration has of showing strategic patience in its foreign policy, which is now the kind of Obama doctrine, maybe it's a good idea, but other actors aren't showing an awful lot of patience on their part.
Indeed. Tim, I understand you covered a speech by Jeb Bush on foreign policy, or have written about it. It was in Chicago. Jeb Bush, of course, is the son of George H.W. Bush, America's 41st president, and the brother of George W. Bush, the 43rd president. Jeb Bush was governor of Florida, but he left office in 2007. That's been a while, but yet he's obviously now running for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016. What didn't you like about his foreign policy speech?
Well, so he gave what was supposed to be his first national security address, and I thought he bumbled through the facts. He made pretty critical errors, and he mispronounced some pretty important things. You know, instead of Boko Haram.
I'm sympathetic to the mispronouncing problem.
Instead of Boko Haram, that the extremist group that's killed 10,000 in Nigeria, he called it Boko Haram. He mixed up Iraq and Iran during the speech. Mm-hmm. He said that ISIS had a strength of 200,000, which is 10 times the amount that they actually have. He said that his strategy for fighting the so-called Islamic State is to, quote, take them out.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a serious
a
national
description rather than a strategy.
That is not, he said, take them out is the strategy. Mm-hmm. This is not clearly someone who has not given a lot of thought to national security policy and who is not very knowledgeable about the details of how to defeat these extremist groups. Mm-hmm. And so if Jeb Bush's desire was to go and present himself as qualified and an expert, I thought that was quite the disaster.
Stephen, he says, he's different from his father and his brother, and yet on foreign policy, they have many of the same advisors that his brother had, George Shultz, the former Secretary of State, and any number of others. I drew from the speech broadly, because he wasn't very specific, as Tim suggested, that the foreign policy would be a sort of a typical, more hawkish than Obama, Republican foreign policy.
Right. I don't disagree with some of the criticisms Tim had of the speech. Maybe I'll be a little bit more charitable towards Jeb Bush. I was slightly disappointed in that I've spent a lot of time going back and watching his speeches on issues like education, government, and you could see in those speeches he's very engaged, he's very down, sort of drilled down in the details, mm-hmm. in a way in which he didn't seem to be on foreign policy. Having said that, this wasn't really a national security speech. I don't think it tells us a lot about how Jeb Bush would serve as commander-in-chief. It was clearly a political speech. Bush has problems with the conservative wing of the party on issues like immigration and education. I don't think he has the political latitude to come out and make any sort of deviation from the party line on foreign policy. I think a lot of people said, well, this is just the same, he's going to be the same as his brother. But the reality is, Bush positioned himself, as you said, like a hawkish sort of national security conservative, and that's right exactly where the Republican Party is. So it's not a question of him being like his brother. He's being like every other, Republican. The party has gone to the right in national security since George H.W. Bush, his father, was president. So I don't think we can extrapolate an awful lot about this, how Jeb Bush would handle a particular crisis in 2 years' time if he's president. That will be developed further on. But I think Tim is right that, at some point in this campaign, if he's going to have an effective presidential campaign, and especially with a number of Republican candidates like Marco Rubio sort of trying to pose as experts on foreign policy, he's going to have to show himself a little bit more sort of in tune with the details and the nuts and bolts of foreign policy. And from what we know of his character, I think he's likely to do that. He's a pretty intellectual guy. He studies hard. If he's elected president, I don't think we'll look back on this speech and say, oh, this was the first time we noticed that he wasn't very au fait with foreign policy.
Probably. He's been sort of dubbed the front runner by the press. My own view is, this far ahead of an election year, so much can happen that you don't really have a front runner. But certainly Jeb Bush will have a formidable, well-financed campaign, don't you think, Tim? And just got a couple seconds left here.
Yeah, I mean, you cannot divorce the fact that his last name is Bush from his front-runner status. He may say, I am my own man, but you look at the connections he's built over the years, the people that are in his orbit, the people he's hired as advisors. In very many ways, he is not his own man, and that's a fact.
That's a fact, and that's also all the time we have. Joining us today were Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.